Hi, listeners, and welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and with today's show, we're going to bring a 30-year-old case back to the present and use it to get a sense of what is gripping American media right now as I record this. Unless you've been living under a rock for the last 10 months, you're aware that a police officer named Derek Chauvin was involved in the arrest of a man named George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota in July 2020. Without going into the extensive details of that arrest, Chauvin was videotaped with his knee pressed into Floyd's neck for an extended period of time. Floyd went into distress and passed away. The event immediately became the top news story, and urban centers across the country became the scene of riots and looting. This episode isn't concerned with riots and looting, as interesting a legal issue as those actions may be. While media pundits who sought nothing more than clicks or eyes on the screen were debating the merits of looting and rioting, serious thinkers were on another topic altogether. And it's a topic which many people have recently asked me to explain because a fundamental misunderstanding of this issue has made the debate over it very difficult. Today we're going to talk about qualified immunity. What is it? What does it do? What is the theory behind it? So that you can form your own informed opinion on whether it has a place in contemporary American society or whether it's an outdated concept that we should just get rid of. We're also going to talk a little bit about the difference between parole and probation, prosecuting police officers, and how federal civil rights prosecutions work. The Derek Chauvin trial is bringing those issues back to the forefront. And as I record this, the trial is still going on and may still be going on when this episode is released. So to discuss these topics in a meaningful way, we're going to take a look at another case of police misconduct. On the night of March 2nd, 1991, a man by the name of Rodney Glenn King was watching basketball with friends, drinking 40-ounce bottles of Old English 800, a potent malt liquor. And this was going on in suburban Los Angeles. After the game, at around 12:30 in the morning, King, along with his friends Pooh Allen and Freddie Helms, got into King's Hyundai and started driving down the 210 freeway at speeds which far exceeded the posted speed limit. They were spotted by husband and wife California Highway Patrol team Tim and Melanie Singer. When the Singers attempted to pull King over, he led them on a car chase at speeds up to 117 miles per hour. California Highway Patrol radioed for assistance from the LAPD, who ultimately managed to block King's car. The LAPD immediately assumed jurisdiction, ordering the Highway Patrol to stand down, and attempted to place Rodney King under arrest. Over the course of the next 15 minutes, King suffered over 50 metal baton hits, was kicked repeatedly, and was even shocked with a high-powered taser. The outrage was instantaneous. Los Angeles prosecutors, rather than pursue King for driving while intoxicated, speeding, and resisting arrest, charged the four police officers involved in the beating with assault and excessive use of force. This is the state of California v. Stacy Kuhn, Lawrence Powell, Theodore Briseño, and Timothy Wind. In case you haven't listened to previous episodes and are unfamiliar with the show, I'll reiterate one of my disclaimers here. I do not comment on social issues. There are lots of podcasts devoted to social justice and what we should or should not do as a society to address these perceived problems. Now, those are worthwhile debates, but they aren't the focus of this particular show. I aim to present legal issues, legal arguments, and explain the rulings and decisions on some of these cases which ring a bell in your memory, but which you might not understand quite as well as you might think. So in discussing the Rodney King case, we aren't going to be spending a lot of time discussing race, wealth inequality, or social demographics. We're going to talk about what actually happened and why. Rodney King was born in Sacramento, California on April 2, 1965, though most of his childhood was spent in nearby Altadena. He was one of five children born to Ronald and Odessa King. King was not a stranger to law enforcement. On November 3rd, 1989, he robbed a Korean convenience store in Monterey Park, California. During the robbery, King hit the store owner with an iron bar before grabbing $200 in cash. He was caught and ended up pleading guilty to robbery and was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. He was released on parole December 27th, 1990, and that date is significant, and we'll get into why a little bit later. He had served roughly a year of his sentence when he was released. Now, many people have some familiarity with the terms parole and probation. In our society, which incarcerates individuals at a higher rate than most of the rest of the civilized world, they're common phrases to hear. But unless you actually work in the field of criminal law, chances are you're a bit fuzzy on what parole actually is or what probation actually is and what the difference is between the two. So let's start with probation. Probation is a definite term of supervision imposed in lieu of, or instead of, incarceration. The amount of time a person is put on probation is defined by the severity of the crime that they are convicted of. For example, in New York State, if you're convicted of driving while intoxicated, a misdemeanor, and sentenced to probation, you would have a probationary term of 3 years. Driving while intoxicated is a Class A misdemeanor in New York, and probation term for a Class A misdemeanor is 3 years. Set, simple, easy. Because of this, there is a degree of certainty with probation. In negotiating a plea deal, if a defendant agrees to probation, they'll know how long the probationary term is prior to being sentenced. The term probation is essentially synonymous with oversight. Think of a probationary firefighter or police officer. This is someone who's being observed to see if they meet the required standards. If they do, they're graduated to full status. And if they don't, they're dismissed. The same principle applies to criminal probationers. They're being observed to see if they can conform their behavior to society's laws. If they can, they stay out of jail. If they cannot, then they're incarcerated. Probation, like parole, comes with a set of conditions. The idea being that since a person has been convicted of breaking the law, while incarceration may not be appropriate, law enforcement does feel that some level of oversight into the individual's life is warranted. Probation conditions can be tailored depending on the crime itself. For example, our defendant who was convicted of driving while intoxicated in New York may have to complete certain drunk driving classes or have a specific device inserted into their vehicle, which measures alcohol consumption before the car may be turned on. Someone who's convicted of assault, on the other hand, may have to attend anger management class. If you fail to abide by the conditions, you can be incarcerated for a time period up to however much time is left on your probation. So if you get probation for, say, 5 years, and you violate the terms on the first day, you can face up to 5 years incarceration. On the other hand, if you go 4 years and 11 months without incident, and then you violate, you could potentially serve up to 1 month. Parole, on the other hand, is a mechanism to release people from incarceration early on the grounds that law enforcement now believes that they should start reintegrating into society. A person's term of parole will last from the date of their release until the remainder of their sentence has passed. So if you're sentenced to 10 years prison, for example, and you're released on parole after 7 years, you're on parole for 3 years. It's important to note that parole is not a right. There's a board which determines who will be released on parole and who will not. And an inmate seeking parole may not be granted it on their first, second, or third appearance in front of this board. As a result, there's no defined term of parole. It's simply whatever is left in the sentence. Individuals released on parole also have conditions which they have to abide by in order to stay out of jail. These can be very similar, like I said, to those imposed on people who are on probation. Someone on parole who violates those conditions, for example, by being rearrested, can be sent right back to jail to finish out their original term and then begin whatever the new term would be on the new case that they were arrested for, which resulted in the violation of parole. So with that in mind, we turn back to Rodney King. King was put on parole in December of 1990. which was set to expire at the end of 1991, as he took a 2-year sentence in the end of 1989. So on the night of March 2nd, 1991, into the morning of March 3rd, King understood that if he was rearrested, he would violate the terms of his probation, and he would likely be going back to jail. This is likely why he led the highway patrol on a high-speed chase for over 8 miles, rather than simply pulling over. When King was finally forced to stop, the Singers initially ordered everyone out of the car. King's friends, Allen and Helms, got out and were fortunate enough to be only mildly abused by the LAPD. Allen claims to have been kicked and threatened, while Helms was struck on the head while already on the ground, and his bloody baseball cap was turned over to the police. But King stayed in the car at first. LAPD Sergeant Stacy Kuhn told the Singers that the LAPD was now in charge and ordered King out of the car, again at gunpoint. King emerged from the car, and the officers claim he was acting strangely. They say that he giggled, pointed at them, patted the ground, and then looked up and waved to a helicopter overhead. Kuhn ordered 4 other officers to subdue King with a tactic known as a swarm. In a swarm, multiple officers grab a suspect by the extremities, so the hands and feet, and take him to the ground quickly to overcome any potential resistance. The officers uniformly claim that King resisted arrest. King claims he didn't resist anything. He was also very clearly unarmed. At this point, Sergeant Kuhn tasered King while he was already on the ground. After being tasered, King gets up and tries to run in the vicinity of Officer Lawrence Powell. The officers claim he was trying to attack Powell. King claims he was trying to flee. Powell, regardless, takes out his baton, strikes King with it, knocking him to the ground. Powell, joined by Theodore Briseño and Timothy Wind, all then beat King with their batons, while Kuhn, despite not taking part in the actual baton use, as supervisor, did order the continued use of baton strikes. Kuhn ordered the officers to strike King's joints, his wrists, elbows, knees, and ankles. After over 50 baton strikes, many kicks, King is handcuffed, cords are placed around his feet. He's dragged to the side of the road, where medical assistance is finally called for him. He was taken to Pacifica Hospital, where he was diagnosed with 11 skull fractures, permanent brain damage, broken teeth, broken right ankle, and kidney failure. Hospital blood tests also revealed alcohol over the legal limit, as well as marijuana. No additional drugs beyond that. Now, there's a very good chance that America would never have heard the name Rodney King if it wasn't for another man named George Holliday. Holliday was a plumbing salesman and amateur videographer. During the high-speed chase, King had pulled off the freeway and was driving through residential neighborhoods. He eventually came to a stop right in front of Holliday's apartment building. Holliday observed the incident from roughly 90 feet away. He recorded the entire thing on his brand new camcorder. Holliday's balcony was close and unobstructed. He had a clear line of sight on the entire incident. The recording was roughly 15 minutes long. It's easy enough to find on the internet if you Google it. There are multiple clips on YouTube as well as a full version. But I warn you, it is not for the faint of heart. It is extremely troubling and difficult to watch all the way through. When King was being taken to the hospital, the officers typed out their reports in the terminals inside their police cruisers. Kuhn's report stated, quote, "You just had a big-time use of force, tased and beat the suspect of CHP pursuit," end quote. And in police jargon, "you" stands for undersigned, or the author of the report. Powell also filled out his report in a way that almost seemed to be bragging about the beating. He writes, quote, "I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time," end quote. He also made reference to the scene being something out of Gorillas in the Mist. George Holliday immediately recognized what he had seen and recorded was significant. 2 days after the incident, Holliday called LAPD headquarters to let law enforcement know that he had videotaped the incident. The police, however, had no interest in viewing or even receiving the video. Discouraged that the police were indifferent to seeing how their own officers had behaved, Holliday did the next logical thing. He offered it to KTLA television. They, unlike the police, eagerly accepted it and ran cuts of the video in prime time. The footage became an instant media sensation. KTLA News cut the footage down. Before Holiday was able to get the camcorder in focus, there's about 10 seconds of blurry video where you can just make out King rising to his feet and taking a step towards one of the officers. That footage was not aired. Outrage does not even begin to cover the reaction to the footage of King's beating. The four officers, Kuhn, Powell, Briseño, and Wind, were arrested and criminally charged. On March 7th, 1991, Police Chief Daryl Gates condemned the, quote, very, very extreme, end quote, use of force, and said the officers would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. In 1991, same as now, it was incredibly rare to even consider arresting and charging a police officer for actions taken while on duty. It remains incredibly rare, which is why situations like the Derek Chauvin trial get such immediate and national press coverage. So at this point, I think it's important to explain qualified immunity. This is a phrase that's thrown around quite a bit, often by people who do not fully understand what it is and what it does. I see and hear celebrities, athletes, and firebrand lawmakers always happy to weigh in on topics that they don't really understand, who have advocated for repealing qualified immunity because it shields bad police officers from being prosecuted for crimes. In a nutshell, that is utter and complete nonsense. If police officer Dave Johnson is on patrol, he observes some minor criminal activity, but he pulls out his gun and shoots a suspect without any provocation whatsoever, qualified immunity does not apply to any potential criminal charges brought against Officer Johnson. So anytime someone tells you that qualified immunity is problematic because it shields bad cops from criminal charges, you can politely explain to them what the doctrine of qualified immunity actually does. It protects government actors, including police officers, from civil suits relating to their official actions unless the plaintiff can show that the actor violated clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which that person was or should have been aware. Now, in plain English, what that means is that people who work for the government who make reasonable judgment calls which turn out to be mistakes cannot be held personally liable in a civil lawsuit. The doctrine came about in the late 1960s during the Civil Rights era in a Supreme Court case called Pearson v. Ray. The Supreme Court was attempting to curb frivolous lawsuits filed against police officers who were acting in good faith. The court felt that there was a substantial danger that police would fail to act in a way that they should for fear that they would be sued as a result. We most often see qualified immunity cited in cases where plaintiffs allege civil rights violations by members of a police department. In the early 1980s, qualified immunity received a minor overhaul and a test was created. The case of Harlow v. Fitzgerald went to the Supreme Court, who clarified for the first time that qualified immunity only applied to government officials if the following two criteria were met. First, the official believed in good faith that their conduct was lawful. And second, that the conduct was objectively reasonable. This test presented an obvious paradox. For a person to be immune from being sued, their mindset had to be that they were acting in good faith. But what a person is thinking is typically a question of fact, which is something that is determined by a jury. So qualified immunity created a bit of a catch-22, as a trial was necessary to determine whether a trial could even take place. This led to changing to the current doctrine. As I stated at the outset of the discussion on this topic, government actors now are shielded from civil liability insofar as their conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights which the actor knew or should have known about. The difference here is that the new standard removes the subjective state of mind standard. No longer is good faith a part of the consideration. Now, everything hinges on whether a reasonable person would determine that the conduct violated a person's rights. Where much of the discussion now tends to in determining whether qualified immunity applies is the question of whether the individual violated a clearly established right. So what does that even mean, clearly established right? Can a right be established but not clearly established? Would that then result in the police officer being shielded from a lawsuit? The answer is that the Supreme Court declined to define what clearly established actually means. Now, we're not going to go too far into the weeds on this topic, but suffice it to say that certain important rights are clearly established without question, while others are largely dependent on what the law is and how well known the statutes governing that conduct are. In practice, when a police officer is asserting a qualified immunity defense for something like the use of excessive force or wrongful death resulting from a shooting, a judge is being asked to make a determination as to the objective reasonableness of the cop's actions based on what his knowledge of the situation was at the time he acted. If the judge finds that the actions were objectively reasonable based on the unique circumstances, then the officer is shielded. Okay, now you are a certified expert in qualified immunity in civil lawsuits. And please correct anyone who asserts that it protects cops from criminal charges. It most certainly does not. It has no applicability towards criminal conduct whatsoever. So now we know that qualified immunity was not going to dismiss the charges against Kuhn, Powell, Briseno, and Wendt. The attention that the case was getting never waned. The officers were vilified in the media. And interestingly enough, the early focus of the media attention was solely on the violence of the officers. Race was not a part of the case. That changed when Lawrence Powell's police report was leaked and the media got a hold of his comparison of the scene to Gorillas in the Mist. That prompted Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley to declare, quote, "There appears to be a dangerous trend of racially motivated incidents running through at least some segments of the police department," end quote. From that moment on, rightly or wrongly, the beating of Rodney King was about racism. The case was assigned to the Honorable Judge Bernard Kamens. Immediately, attorneys for the four cops filed a joint motion for a change in venue, claiming that they could not get a fair trial in Los Angeles. Judge Kamens heard arguments from both sides. All four defense attorneys made strong arguments, presented statistics about the media coverage, gave multiple examples of fabrications printed in the newspaper and covered by cable news networks in their attempt to show that the jury pool in LA had been hopelessly saturated with not only news but false accounts about the incident. They claimed that there was simply no way to get a jury who didn't have some preconceived biases in Los Angeles County. The prosecutor seemed unconcerned about the motion, did not speak for very long at the hearing. In California, the chances of a defense attorney winning on a motion to change venue are extremely low. So it's possible that the prosecutors simply did not consider it a realistic possibility. And in fact, Judge Kamens did deny the defense motion. But it seems that there was perhaps another reason that the prosecution team felt confident and was not compelled to work hard on their opposition to the defense motion. When the defense attorneys appealed Judge Kamen's ruling, the California Court of Appeals unanimously agreed to grant their motion to change venue and then removed Judge Kamen's from the case on account of bias. It came out that Judge Kamens had sent an ex parte message to the prosecutors, which said, quote, "Don't panic, you can trust me," end quote. Ex parte means that only one side received the message. So the defense attorneys were not aware that the communication had been made. There are strict rules about attorneys' communications with judges. There are very limited circumstances which permit messages to go from one party to a judge or vice versa without the other side being involved. It should come as no surprise that this was not one of those categories. The Court of Appeals then moved the case from Los Angeles to Simi Valley, a predominantly white, conservative, small city in Ventura County. This was possibly the best news the defense attorneys could possibly have received. With this switch, expectations for jurors flipped. In LA, prosecutors could count on seating a jury comprised mainly of minorities who were hostile towards the police. They would be liberal. They would identify with King. In Simi Valley, the defense could now count on a majority of the jury to be white conservatives who were openly suspicious of King, largely registered gun owners and supporters of law enforcement. Jury selection took place in early March 1992. Of the 260-person jury pool, six were African-American. Five of those had no interest in serving on the jury, and the lawyer for Officer Lawrence Powell struck the sixth. Two seated jurors were NRA members, two were military veterans, 10 jurors were white, one was biracial, one was Latino, and one was Asian. The trial itself was very straightforward. Most of the charges were filed against Kuhn and Powell. They had multiple counts of assault and using excessive force and filing false police reports. Briseño and Wind had one count of assault each. Terry White, the lead prosecutor, played the tape aired on KTLA News and argued that the video spoke for itself. He reiterated over and over again during the trial King's injuries, the number of times he was hit with batons, the order to focus on King's joints, the use of a taser, and how proud the officers all seemed to be of themselves after King was taken to the hospital. It wasn't fancy, it was cut and dry. White claimed that everything the jury needed to consider was contained in the footage of King being savagely attacked. In a strategic move, White did not call Rodney King as a witness in the trial. The main witness was Melanie Singer. White was concerned about King testifying for a number of reasons. First, King was so drunk at the time, his memory of the events were hazy at best. It would have also opened him up to cross-examination about being on parole and his prior act of violence. After numerous conversations with King, White was also concerned that King would lose his temper and alienate jurors by being overly antagonistic on cross-examination. So White made the call, and King was left off the stand. One of the most interesting things about the trial was that the defense attorneys employed significantly different strategies. Daryl Maunger, the attorney for Kuhn, and Michael Stone, the attorney for Powell, blamed King for the whole situation. John Barnett, the attorney for Briseño, on the other hand, placed all the blame on Powell, claimed he had been out of control. And Paula DePasquale, the attorney for Wind, largely sat back and did nothing, as the prosecution's direct case said very little that concerned Wind. None of the evidence actually pointed to Wind doing anything. Three of the defendants testified. Kuhn went first. He stated that in the moment, he was afraid, based on how King was acting. He described how he followed the appropriate protocols of force usage. He issued verbal commands, then a swarm takedown, then the use of a taser, and when all else failed, the baton. He claimed King's behavior led him to believe that he was on PCP. He came across as sincere in his belief that the force used to subdue King had been appropriate. And the most effective defense witness other than Kuhn was Sergeant Charles Duke. Duke went through the videotape frame by frame and backed up Kuhn's claim that the force used was reasonable. Duke was an expert witness on the use of force and had testified in several other trials for the police department as somebody knowledgeable on that subject. Powell's testimony consisted of repeating that he was scared for his life during the encounter and that he was just following orders. It was rambling, it was largely incoherent, and it was not effective. Briseño's testimony helped the prosecution more than any defendant. He claimed that Powell was out of control and gave King an extreme beating. Wind did not testify on advice of counsel. DePasquale felt that since none of the evidence was relating to Wind, that it was best for him to just allow the jury to forget about him. The defense attorneys did make a savvy move at the end of the trial. They played the blurry part of the tape that the prosecution had not. Despite being blurry, they were able to then argue that the tape showed King get up and start towards Powell. This movement, they all claimed, justified the officer's fear that King was attacking and necessitated the use of force to bring him down. The jury deliberated for 7 days. Jurors would later recount that they reached acquittal verdicts for Briseño and Wind very quickly, and Kuhn not too far after. Most of the deliberation revolved around Powell. Powell was shown in the videotape to be the most aggressive officer by far. Powell was ultimately acquitted on all but one assault charge, where the jury hung. Less than 2 hours later, the city of Los Angeles was in flames. For the purposes of this podcast, I'm not going to spend any time discussing the riots, as they are a social justice slash race relations topic, and my show avoids those types of discussions. I will say, however, that in the 6 days of riots that followed the Rodney King verdict, 63 people lost their lives, 2,383 more were injured, and over $1 billion in property damage was done. King himself tried to quell the unrest, uttering the now famous line, "Can we all get along?" in a television press conference aimed at ending the riots. That line is often now misquoted as either, "Can we all just get along?" or "Can't we all get along?" Our final consideration in this episode is federal civil rights cases. The four officers in this case were acquitted by a Simi Valley jury of the criminal charges, except for the one charge against Powell that hung, but those were all state-level criminal actions. The Department of Justice has the authority to pursue a federal prosecution against individuals who violate the civil rights of others, as there are federal criminal statutes which prohibit such conduct. All four officers in this case were indicted on August 4th, 1992, in the Central District of California District Court. This is just a few months after their acquittal. The prosecution is inherently the same as a normal federal criminal prosecution. The main difference is that while most federal statutes ban certain behavior as being a criminal action perpetrated against the country, these particular prosecutions are based on the idea that certain actions taken against other people, and specifically against their constitutional rights, are illegal. Rodney King, federal prosecutor Stephen Clymer argued, had the right not to be subject to an excessive beating while being placed under arrest. Clymer had several benefits. The federal jury was much more diverse. He had had the opportunity to review what was effective in the state trial and what wasn't, and he had responses for all the defense arguments. King was also put on the stand and was actually quite an effective witness in the federal case. Clymer was regarded as the best trial attorney in the United States Attorney's Office for the Central District of California at the time, which included Los Angeles. He was able to convince the jury that Kuhn and Powell had violated King's constitutional rights by beating and assaulting him. Briseño and Wind, interestingly enough, were acquitted again. Punishments for violating civil rights are different than a standard criminal charge. At the base level, if a person is convicted of violating another's rights, the sentence can be up to a $1,000 fine or up to 1 year in jail. If the violation involves a physical injury to the victim, the potential fine is increased to up to $10,000, and imprisonment can be up to 10 years. If the victim dies, any term of incarceration can be applied. Since King was obviously injured, both Kuhn and Powell were ultimately sentenced to 30 months in prison for their role in the assault of Rodney King. In summation, the Simi Valley trial emphasizes just how much the jury pool matters. Had the state prosecution remained in Los Angeles, it's hard to imagine any of these officers being acquitted. Terry White also made several mistakes, which ended up costing him. By only showing some of the video, it opened the door to defense attorney arguments accusing him of trying to hide portions of the video from the jury because they contradicted his arguments. It doesn't matter if they actually did or did not contradict his arguments. That being explained to the jury is an extremely effective tool. The same consideration applied to the decision not to have Rodney King testify. It again appeared as though the prosecution was hiding him and opened the door to defense attorneys claiming as such. The attorneys for the officers lucked out. They were given a huge gift by the California Court of Appeals, who could have easily moved the trial to a more racially diverse area. Knowing that the proliferation of the video was going to be an issue for them, they did themselves no favors by having such different trial strategies. It's really amazing that Powell was acquitted based on what Briseño testified to. I also think Terry White played the videotape entirely too many times during the trial. If you have listened to past episodes, you've heard me say over and over again that one fatal mistake that too many trial lawyers make is that they overtry their case. Here, White played the tape so many times, slow motion, that the effect was lost over the course of the multi-month trial. Jurors simply became too desensitized to it. That worked tremendously to the defendant's advantages. Know your narrative, stick to it, hammer it, but don't ever devalue the best piece of evidence you have by draining it of its shock value. Terry White learned that the hard way. I'm proud to announce that I now have my first listeners from both Africa and South America. So to my lone listeners in South Africa and Argentina, thank you. I hope you enjoyed the show and will spread the word. Thanks to you, I have officially reached every inhabited continent. On that note, if you have a case, a topic, or a legal issue which you want to discuss, or if you just want to send me your thoughts on any episode, you can reach me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Facebook at the Insummation Podcast page, or tweet me at insummationpod. If you prefer the old-fashioned way, you can always look me up through my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on whatever platform you listen to, as that will help other people find it and maybe get some new people involved in critical thinking on legal issues in ways they've never encountered before. As always, a huge thank you to Dan Townsend, my brother and audio engineer, for making this podcast a listenable experience. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more. Whoa.